Hello, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I'm Carl from selfsufficienthub.com, and I'm here to talk about all things self-sufficiency, all things homesteading, and about how we can reduce the gap between our consumption and our production. Sustainability and food security matters. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 310 of the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I hope you're all safe and well. Today is our Ask Me Anything episode. It's an episode I've been looking forward to recording and looking forward to sharing with you guys a great deal. I've got lots of questions and I haven't read any of them in advance. I'm going to read them as we go. That's how I like to do it. So they're kind of honest, genuine, off-the-cuff answers. Before we get into our first question, I'll just say there will be, we're back to our giveaways on Fridays. I'm not sure what it'll be this week, but if you want to be included in the draw for our giveaways, all you need to do is become a patron of the show. Lots of information out there how to do that, but of course it's just go to patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. And I just want to take the time to thank you every listener for your listens. Thank you for everyone who's sent in questions, and without further ado, let's get into it. So I'm going to start with an email from Rory Ashworth. He writes the following. Hi, Carl. Love the podcast. You're my number one listen to on Spotify, and I listen to a lot. Like you, I've recently just had the stress of moving and dismantling all of my hard work to restart again, but onwards and upwards. And it brings new opportunities, even in much smaller spaces. I know you're a keen mushroom man like me, so my questions revolve mainly around that. A few questions I have, feel free to ignore some, and they are the following. Have you ever introduced mushrooms into your garden slash homestead? If so, which species, and advise viewers how? What is your favourite use for excessive courgette production? Which animal do you most regret introducing to your homestead and why? Have you ever preserved slash canned wild mushrooms? If so, how? Have you done any guerrilla gardening? Love the channel, love the podcast. Definitely get Alan and Mike on soon. There you got a lot in there. Thank you, Rory. Thank you ever so much for your email. And I hope you're listening, Alan and Mike. There you go. You have to get on the podcast soon again. And we'd love to have you, obviously. So I'll go through your questions now, one at a time. Have you ever introduced mushrooms into your garden slash homestead? If so, which species, and advise viewers how? Well, I have attempted it unsuccessfully a few times. So a few examples of things that I've done are we've bought some plugs, the little dowels that you plug into logs, and we tried that with lion's mane, oyster mushrooms, and one other species which eludes me, probably shiitake, and it was unsuccessful. But I put that down largely to my lackadaisical manner around the sort of management of those logs. Is there, you get quite specific instructions of how to look after them, and I won't lie, I kind of left them to their own devices and nothing came of it. I suppose for me, the main reason why I haven't really focused on that is just because of the abundance of wild mushrooms out there. There's never, ever been a time in as long as I can remember when we haven't had mushrooms on the shelf ready to use. Quite a few different varieties, really, just from what's available in the wild. So that's why I haven't. So I'm not really able to advise anyone how to do it. But if it is something you were interested in, there are lots of mushroom kits out there that you can go and collect. Now, with regards to trying to propagate wild mushrooms, I've done things like, when I've harvested puffballs, if there are giant puffballs somewhere and there's a couple that are gone over and they've turned to spores, I will bring some of those home and try and spread the spores around our area here at home. But again, it's difficult to know whether or not that's been successful, because there may well be some giant puffballs that have spored and reproduced here on our land, but perhaps might take a few years before they're established enough to actually fruit. I will never know, but I will continue trying to sort of spread spores of the mushrooms that I enjoy closer to my home, wherever that is. And we'll never really know how successful our efforts are, because even if they were successful, we wouldn't ever be able to pin that down to our efforts versus the efforts of just what's going on in the wild, of them propagating themselves. So I think that rounds out everything I have to say on that question, really. Next up, what's your favourite use for excessive courgette production? Well, I'd done a YouTube video, I think, called five different things to do with a courgette glut. And within them, the two that I use most of our excess courgettes with are really, really covered by just two things. One is we freeze a great deal. So we freeze a lot of courgettes. You can do that either by blanching them and freezing them, or simply by freezing them, if, you know, just chopping them up and freezing them if you want them to go into like a ratatouille or something where you don't mind them breaking down. And the other thing we do is we make a tremendous amount of courgette chutney, which we eat throughout the year. I absolutely love it, and it goes fantastically with cheese. I like to add a little bit of chili to mine, but then that goes for most things I eat. So courgette chutney and freezing are the two ways that we use most of our excessive courgette production up. Next, which animal do you most regret introducing to the homestead and why? I can honestly say that we don't have a single case of an animal that I've genuinely regretted. We have had some ducks in the past, which all got taken by the fox, and that's unfortunate. We did get some eggs out of them before that happened, but I suppose that's the only real set of failure is the ducks that we lost. Other than that, I genuinely don't have any regrets on any of the animals that we brought in. I've regretted perhaps bringing them in a week before we've had the fencing complete for some things, or not quite had the infrastructure in place. But I don't think I can say honestly that I've regretted bringing any animal into the homestead. So that makes me feel quite good about myself, I have to say. Have you ever preserved / canned wild mushrooms? If so, how? Well, I definitely preserve them. And we preserve almost all the wild mushrooms that we bring home just by dehydrating them. And they are just, it's the easiest thing to do in the world. They dehydrate really well. Most of them dehydrate and then rehydrate really well. There are some mushrooms, for instance, the shaggy parasol, which we have quite a few that grow around here, and we dehydrate those. And I actually love those on pizzas and things like that, where we add them still dehydrated and they just cook, absorb all the fats and things that come off of the cheese, and they just cook from dehydrated. Others that we will rehydrate, which gives us not only the rehydrated mushrooms but then also some amazing mushroom stock. So yeah, dehydration is definitely my go-to preservation method for my wild mushrooms. Last question, have you ever done any guerrilla gardening? I've done an episode on guerrilla gardening, and that's, I think, as close as I've got. I may have done some that I'm not remembering, but I don't think we've ever really done any. We've not really had the need because we've had so much space, but of course that may very well change in the future as we move to a much smaller property. So watch this space. So those are the questions from Rory Ashworth. Thank you ever so much for getting in touch. I genuinely appreciate it. Really appreciate your questions. Right, next up is an email from Alex Todd. He writes, "Dear Carl, heard episode 310 is an Ask Me Anything, and this will be my first to get one in. Here's my question. I'm about to get into the activity of kidding and milking my two female goats. What do you consider the must-dos and must-avoids? Thanks for all your help as always. Best, Alex from the Net Zero Homestead." Well, Alex has been, or is still currently, going through my back catalogue. He started at episode 1, and I think he's about a year away, a year behind. He occasionally skips forwards to a current episode, but he's going through my back catalogue, and it's fantastic because I occasionally get like a time machine version of an email from him, which is just really great. And so this question, he's recently got some goats, as I know, and you're looking at kidding and milking. Well, when it comes to kidding, the first thing I will say is that most of our kidding has just been really, really down to the goats, and they've done a great job. It's only very rarely have we actually been there throughout the kidding process. Now, just recently, that has been a godsend, and my wife was able to save some kids that probably would have been stillborn otherwise. Or I don't know if the word is stillborn, if they actually died during childbirth. I just don't know. But that's the first time I can think of that happening. Generally speaking, the girls will look after themselves. I think when it comes to kidding, the thing to ask yourself is, you know, are they healthy? Do they look well in themselves going into it? And just make sure that they've got plenty of food and somewhere nice and dry and warm to get out of the elements while they go through the process. After that, you know, they're pretty good. They're, in my experience at least, I'm not the most experienced goat keeper, of course, but in our experience, I have to say that they take care of most of it pretty much themselves. When it comes to milking, there's lots of different ways to go about it. What we tend to do is we leave the kids with mum, and after about 4 or 5 weeks, maybe a bit longer, you'll notice the kids have a huge growth spurt when they're first born, and then it kind of starts to level out a little bit and the growth slows down after a few weeks. And around that time is when we will start milking, and we will start just taking the tiniest amount of milk. And what we're basically trying to do is we're trying to keep the mums producing the milk as if they were producing it when their kids were at their kind of peak consumption, while the kids are weaning and the kids are gradually moving away from the milk and onto solid food. And while they're doing that, we're filling that gap. So we very, very gradually increase the amount of milk that we take over the course of a month or more. And I suppose the only other thing is to watch the kids, because some of them just simply won't wean. We had a kid before called, I can't remember his name, Twiglet. And he, after a year with his mum, was still milking, and we had to separate them. That was the only way we could do it. So that's one of the tips, is, you know, just keep an eye on the kids. Other than that, just go slow, you know, go steady, do what you're comfortable with and do what mum's comfortable with. You know, if you struggle the first time, don't forget that the goats, if the first time you go to milk them, if that's a horrible experience for mum, that's what she's going to remember. So try and go into it and make sure that she is super comfortable. You know, milk her while you're giving her some treats, some, you know, give her some food that she really, really enjoys, so that she associates that process as a positive thing. And other than that, you know, just take your time and ease into it. I'm sure that you'll be just fine. Hi guys, I'm just very quickly interrupting the show to say please consider supporting it. If you'd like to consider supporting this one-man operation, there's lots of ways you can do it. One of the easiest of which is just to talk about it, to share it online, on your social media pages, or with friends. By growing this audience is one of the best ways that we can actually ensure that the show is sustainable. If you'd like to support it more directly, then please consider becoming a patron. You can do so by going to patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. By becoming a patron, you help me to achieve things that I'd love to be able to do in the future, such as buying better equipment to increase the quality, allowing me to pay myself some time to spend on the podcast, again increasing the quality of it, and also paying for things like transcription and show notes. If you would like to do that, please do consider going to patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. Thank you. Everything you do to support this show is really appreciated. My next question is from Ashley, who writes, "Hi Carl, thanks for the podcast. Here's my question for your Ask Me Anything episode. If money was no object, describe your perfect homestead. All the best, Ash." Right. Well, what a question. I think, sort of, if money was no object, but semi-realistically, something that I could see actually happening one day maybe, would be, obviously, lots of land. I wouldn't want much more than I've got now. Maybe 8 acres, I think, is about perfect. But obviously, that would be 8 acres that was all productive. And we'd have maybe a cow or two. certainly some goats, and that would take care of more than take care of our dairy. And we'd probably stagger the feeding, so we'd have goat's milk for 6 months of the year and cow's milk for 6 months of the year, something like that. We'd probably have a similar amount of chickens that we've had over the last year or so. I think that was just about the right amount. It gave us the right amount of meat, the right amount of eggs. We would maybe, with the same number of chickens, we would maybe focus a little bit more on breeding so that we did have a bit more chicken meat. But I think that is about right. We'd have our pigs. So very similar to how we've had it recently. A few more beehives, certainly. And other than that, where the money really comes in, what I would love to do one day, my dream is to build our own home in the middle of this field that is our dream homestead. And what I really, really would love, if money was no object, this is the thing that definitely I would love to do, is have a big room next to the kitchen so that it's basically shut off from the kitchen. So when we're in our family home and our family kitchen, we don't see it. But all we need to do is go through a door and have a giant second kitchen that was basically refrigerated and stainless steel units everywhere. And that is where I could do things like hang animals, hang meat. I could do all of my butchering and processing and anything else I wanted to do within that sort of climate controlled space. Maybe there would be a wall down the middle, a glass wall with a door in it, and one side would be a refrigerated temperature and the other side would be room temperature, something like that. But, you know, a proper industrial style workspace for things like butchering. I would love that so much. And again, that really is a if money was no object thing. I've looked into the idea and thought about it long and hard how we would do it. And, you know, it wouldn't cost too much to do a version of it, but to do it right would be quite expensive. And, you know, I'm definitely not saying never, maybe one day, but it would be available to me perhaps without excessive cost because I'd be able to do so much of it myself. But one of the things I've been looking into, and there isn't a sort of a specific unit that does this yet, but I'm sure there will be, because I'm sure commercial companies, places like McDonald's and those kind of and supermarkets that would use this kind of thing will drive the technology this way. But basically, you can buy, as you guys will know, these are things that are familiar to all of us, you can buy something called an air source heat pump, and it's basically a way of heating your water in your house, and it takes the air temperature and basically works like a fridge in reverse. And of course, you can buy air conditioning units, and these two things basically work in reverse. Now, if you've got an air source heat pump, which is heating up water, it's spitting out loads and loads of cold air. And if you've got an air conditioning unit, that's going to spit out hot air, just like the air that comes out the back of your fridge is quite warm. Well, I would like one of these units built into the wall in between our sort of living space and the refrigerated space, so that on one side it's warming up and on the other side it's cooling down and doing the same job. Obviously, it would need to be vented both sides, so that if one side needed to overproduce, it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't need to have the temperature in your house get too high or the temperature in your fridge get too cold. But I just think that would be a super efficient way of managing your heating in both areas. And hopefully soon there will be some kind of product on the market that would do that job. I'm very excited about that. And if money was no object, properly no object, if I was Elon Musk, that's probably where I would start focusing my attention anyway. But anyway, thank you for the question, Ashley. On to the next one. This is from Jonathan Wilkinson. And he writes simply, "Hi Carl, this is my question. Will your kids do what you're doing when they grow older, do you think? Thanks for the podcast." Okay, Jonathan. Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I genuinely don't know. I think as parents, all we can do is give our children the tools, give our children the knowledge and the, I suppose the way I look at it, give them the sort of the means to make ethical decisions, give them those ethical foundations upon which they can make their own decisions. It's always been huge for me, even before we lived here, even before I was involved in all the things I'm in now, involved in this movement, if you like, it was always really important to me that our children knew where food came from. From a very, very early age, I would take them, when I took them to the supermarket, you know, I would say, you know, where does, we'd stand at the butchery counter and I'd say, well, what's that piece of meat? What animal does that come from? It was very important to me that they understood the link between what we consume and, you know, where it comes from. And I think that's all we can do, really, is to put those pieces of the puzzle in place and then encourage them to do what they want and do what they love. And I'd like to think, hopefully, one day they will settle into something similar, maybe one of them, maybe two of them. But, you know, it really is up to them, and I genuinely don't know. I think, much like myself, I think they'll have to go through their own path in life of being rebellious teenagers and then slightly irresponsible adolescents and, you know, younger people before they really find themselves. You know, it took me until the age of 40, really, to stumble into what I'm doing now. So I think it can take time. And it's something that maybe can come after you've achieved certain career goals and things like that. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I hope so. I certainly hope so. Right. Let's have a look. Next question is from Deb Shipton, another Patreon and supporter of the show in all its forms for a very long time. Hi, Deb. She writes, hi, Carl. Just a few questions that came to mind. What are your short-term plans, re dairy, for your family? Are you able to source goat or indeed cow's milk locally, or will you have to buy it from the supermarket? How many chickens will you be able to keep at your new home? And how are the kids feeling about moving? Will the move make it easier or more difficult to pursue the type of outside income that you want for yourself in the long term, i.e. foraging courses? What's happening with your bees? Cheers and congrats on reaching another milestone with your podcast, Jeff and Deb Shipton. Thank you guys for your question or questions. So I'll go through them one at a time like I did earlier. What your short-term plans are, dairy, for your family? Are you able to source goat or indeed cow's milk locally, or will you have to buy from the supermarket? Well, I'll answer that question and then I'll go on to talk about how, you know, this is one of the things we're actually seeing as a bit of an opportunity as well as a cost. So our short-term plans are, yes, we'll be buying it, obviously, but we are able to source goat and cow's milk locally. So there's lots of places locally where we can literally buy unpasteurized, full-fat, whole cow's milk, and the same with goat's milk. There's actually a goat farm fairly near us, although it'll be slightly further away after we move. And when it comes to cow's milk, we're spoilt for choice here. We live in dairy country, so there are lots and lots of dairies, not all of which, but a few of which will sell their milk locally. And it means that you're buying that milk with all of those good bacteria and everything in, which you want for things like cheese making. So that leads us on to the question of cheese making. And, you know, this is where we're seeing it as an opportunity, because where we are going to be having different types of milk more often, we're going to try making other types of cheese. So we will still be making goat's cheese, although I've still got quite a bit in the freezer from this year. But we're going to be making, or attempting, trying to learn things like cheddars and some of the more common cow's cheeses. So it's an opportunity for me to branch out, if you like. So that's where we are with regards to dairy. Now, of course, we only used our goat's milk for about 6 to 9 months of the year anyway. We were already purchasing milk outside of that time. So it's not a huge jar for us to, you know, move that way full time temporarily and see where we go. How many chickens will you be able to keep at your new home? Well, that is still up for debate. We could keep, we have had in the past there, probably 12. We could probably keep up to around 20, but then that would take up quite a lot of space versus other things. So I think we're probably going to keep around, I would say, between 6 and 12. The number will fluctuate, and we're definitely going to have enough to meet our own eggs needs. And that's probably it, I think. And when I say meet our own eggs needs, we're probably going to have enough to meet our own eggs needs through the winter, so long as we are able to preserve a few in the summer. That's our plan. So we'll just have to wait and see how that goes. And they're going to be a mixture of different birds, different types. We're going to have some that are specific, just egg layers. And my wife has got her flock of bantams, which are definitely coming with us. Our little bantams that actually at the moment are laying 4 or 5 eggs a day, just between the 6 of those. So that's going to be where we are. How do the kids feel about moving? They are totally okay with it. They're actually looking forward to it, some of them, because they're back amongst their friends. They're back amongst the people they grew up with and the people they still go to school with at the moment. Particularly one of my children who's a real social butterfly, and we're having to drive him around all over the place so he can see people. He'll be able to go and meet his friends on his bicycle, etc. So they are certainly not upset about it, and some of them are really looking forward to it. Of course, they'll miss some of the garden here, but I have to be honest, it's amazing how little they use it. It really is. But so that's one of the biggest things we were concerned about that has gone really well. So there you go. Will the move make it easier or more difficult to pursue the type of outdoor income that you want for yourself long term, i.e. foraging courses? Well, it's not going to have an impact on the foraging courses, which is great. So we've got a full itinerary of foraging courses up for the year, which can be found at selfsufficienthub.com. If you struggle to find them, I found the easiest way is just to type in Foraging Somerset Self-Sufficient Hub in your Google browser, or just Foraging Somerset. We usually come up as one of the top searches, and that's got our itinerary on there for this year. And yeah, that's gone really well. I've also received several private bookings outside of those dates, and that's going from strength to strength. That really is going well. There are some other things I'd like to do. I'd like to do some other bushcrafty type learning days, but I think that's going to be one of the first things that we consider when we're looking at somewhere to buy. You know, when we buy a field, we want to be able to run some kind of courses there, because that's a big part of why it's difficult for us to find somewhere to rent. Because if you rent, you can't really build a classroom or any, you know, big infrastructure. So that's definitely something that we're pursuing. It's not changed and hasn't really been detrimentally affected too much by the move. What's happening with your bees? They are going to be moving to my father-in-law's, and that'll be in the next week or two. And that's it. That brings us to the end of your questions. Thank you ever so much, Deb and Jeff. And thank you, as always, for your support of the show. And finally, we have a question from Susan Schrift. Who is your fussiest eater in your house? What do they eat and not eat? And what do you do about it? Well, Susan, interesting stories around this. I mean, my wife used to be quite a fussy eater when we met. She's slightly less so now. But when we first met, she wouldn't eat cheese. She wouldn't eat mushrooms. She wouldn't eat a plethora of things. She wouldn't eat most fish. She wouldn't eat any spicy food at all. These are all things she's come around to in varying degrees. I think the trouble is I consider almost everyone to be a fussy eater because I eat everything. So there's literally nothing you could put in front of me that I wouldn't enjoy if it was cooked well. So there's that, you know, so they've got a really high bar that I've set everybody. And, you know, in addition, a lot of them are children, so you can't expect them to be quite as wide with their palates. But what we do when we sit down, I kind of insist everybody tries a little bit of everything. So, you know, if we cook a roast dinner, I put lots and lots of veggies on the table, some of which we as a family had never eaten before. So I did Jerusalem artichokes for the first time yesterday. I did some spiced pumpkin puree, slightly different than I'd ever made before. And, you know, and Brussels sprouts, none of these things are their favourites or things that they've had before. So I, you know, said, you don't have to eat a lot, but you must eat a little bit of everything. And I think by constantly exposing ourselves to new flavours, then we get better. My daughter doesn't like ham, allegedly. Depends how it's cooked. So, you know, we do things like I completely slow roast or slow cook a ham in the slow cooker so it sort of falls apart. And then what I will do is I will cook a carbonara type sauce with chicken and the ham in, so that the ham literally falls apart into like fibers, so that it's not in the sort of chunks that can be removed and left quite so easily. And that, and my daughter likes it like that. She said, no, I like the ham when it's like this. So, you know, little accommodations like that can go a long way towards getting people on board with certain meats, certain flavors, certain food types. And like I say, just the constant exposure to them, I think, makes a difference. Our children eat lots of food now that once upon a time they wouldn't have eaten, they wouldn't have touched. And, you know, it's our job as parents to be patient and also to continue to expose our children to these things, I think, and, you know, do it with a kind and patient mentality, because we should also try and remember when we were children and perhaps were fussy eaters. Yeah, so I think if I had to give an award for the fussiest, I think it really depends on the category. You know, whatever I'm serving, there's going to be someone who is not going to enjoy it as much as everybody else. I think fussiest would probably go to my youngest son, Torrin, at the moment, because he will decide he doesn't enjoy something that he enjoyed 2 weeks ago. And there you go. But that's part of being a child, isn't it? But I don't really want to, I might take that back. I don't really want to hand out a badge or a prize for the fussiest, because everyone in my house is quite good. And they are good because of Dad. You know, they know how much it means to me, so they all try, and they're very, very patient with trying new things, even though they don't really want to. And they'll constantly say things like, well, I can tell that it's been cooked really well, and I'm sure that if you liked this type of food, it would be lovely, but I didn't really enjoy it. What more can you ask for, really? How considerate is that? Anyway, that's the last question that we have today. Thank you ever so much to everyone who got questions in. I really, really appreciate it. And yeah, there you go. And there's a few other emails I need to get to, which I haven't had a chance to get to yet. So I will get through those. If a few of those include questions, then I will pick those up later on this week. I'll just add them in at the end of some other episodes, but I do have a barrage of emails I need to get through for this podcast, from the YouTube channel, and for work. So I'm a little bit behind on correspondence. Please forgive me. Doesn't mean I don't value you, and I will get there, I promise. Come and join me later in the week. We'll be doing a giveaway on Friday for something to a Patreon subscriber. And that's it for today. Thank you ever so much for everyone who sent in questions. I genuinely appreciate it. And I'll speak to you guys really soon. Cheers. This episode of the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast was brought to you by our patrons. You guys are awesome. If you'd like to support the show, there's lots of ways you can do it. The easiest of which is just to like and review it wherever you get our podcasts. You can also tell somebody about it, whether that's on social media or just face to face with a friend who you think might benefit from it. But however you support our podcast, we really, really appreciate it. If you'd like to become a patron, please consider doing so by going to patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. However you support the podcast, it's listeners like you that make all of this possible. Thank you ever so much for listening, and I'll speak to you really soon.